gets harder and harder to find a sattvic film. But besides that, I wanted to welcome our new arrivals and hope that you are comfortable and acclimating to this rarefied environment and feeling at home. And it's a joy to have you as part of our tribe. And I hope you won't feel shy in asking questions if you have them about any of the teachings that we discuss. Okay? I know that your intentions of self-realization are what brought you here. And that will be fulfilled simply by opening to being in a completely receptive state without resistance, because the truth is already within. And of course, as we know, it's the resistance that is the cause for the delay, the lag time in what could be an instantaneous liberation, because the illusory ego refuses to withdraw its projections, and the soul is not awakened enough to discern her difference from the ego in order to put it through its necessary ego death, its necessary transformation into capacities that have been sublimated into wisdom, but that no longer contain the sting, the venom of anger or of anxiety, guilt, shame, fear, and the projections of envy upon another because of the inherent sense of lack and inferiority within the subconscious ego, since it was formed when one was physically inferior to the adults around, who may or may not have treated the that sense of personal becoming with unconditional love and sufficient attention and care, and give a sense of recognition and permission to discover one's real self, but rather was imposed upon by the demand to fulfill the desires of the other and the fantasies of the other and the belief system imposed by not just the family system, but the social system of which it was a part, and in which one then became indoctrinated even further. And this caused a forgetting of our real nature. And so now it's requires a process of remembering the lost aspect of the divine nature that was turned into a paranoid, utilitarian, needy, grasping, controlling kind of reified entity that was intending to break free of the other, but never found the strength or the understanding that it must break free of its own internal projections upon the other. And the traces of trauma and of insult that were delivered and have festered in the subconscious rather than being released and purified. And so they produce an ongoing collapsed qualium wave function of ego defense mechanisms as a kind of never again will I become vulnerable and offer my love and my innocence to be harmed again. And so the soul is buried by its own agreement under these mechanisms, and then the programming of the ego takes over and usurps one's life and impersonates one. And after that, one tends to live an inauthentic existence filled with suffering. And that's the story pretty much of Kali Yuga, egoic development as a psychological entity. And once one has developed a rather complicated, at least three-tiered psychological self of a conscious, a censoring agency that's always looking out for information it has to deny, reject, refuse, repress, etc., and that subconscious dungeon of the shadow, as long as that structure is the operative mental apparatus that one has a sense is protecting one from externalized dangers, one cannot recognize that the real danger is that one's own freedom, one's own spontaneity, one's own gift of inherent genius has been repressed along with the soul's fear of being hurt again. And so this creates a massive resistance to the other, to authority, to any force that would threaten the pseudo-autonomy of the ego. And it's always on the edge of a fight or flight reaction and cannot be in a fully receptive mode or a mode of appreciation of all that is given by the real, by the presence that underlies and pervades the world in the forms of nature and all the beauties and the extraordinary phenomena saturated with the divine presence that is in a certain sense censored from one's full appreciation of its aesthetic power, its spiritual power, its inherent values of truth and beauty and love that inherently emanate from the real. And there is therefore an alienation, both from what is projected as being without as well as what lies deep within. And so that self-alienation, that's an alienation from nature and from vulnerability to the other, also eliminates the authentic capacity for rapport, for real, deep, fulfilling love. And so the divine eros is repressed, and instead a very shoddy substitute based on possessiveness and usually one of two modes of interaction, either of intimidation or seduction, takes the place of the capacity of relating in that divine mutuality of recognition of the oneness that pervades the differences of all of the forms of manifestation that constitute the infinite creative power of the inconceivable God Self. And so it's the willingness to risk love and to risk the unknowable self coming fully into one's consciousness and taking over from the ego. It's the courage and the discernment of the urgency of that as one's salvation from suffering and from self-condemnation because of the guilt and shame that accompanies that that alienation from the real, that has created a kind of a hell realm in the microcosm as well as in the macrocosm, because the collective ego is colluding to relate only in a conflictual way and not in a harmonious one. And because egos are in a constant power struggle. It can be very subtle and sophisticated and nuanced, or it can be a brutal fight club, but it's that kind of ultimate my way or the highway sort of relationality that tends to produce the schisms and the divorces and the antagonisms and the factions and the frictions that destroy the harmony and joy of being alive, and which is why there's an underlying collective death drive that is pushing the world at a political and military level and a level of social collapse that is the symptom of all of this toward the ultimate Holocaust as the only escape known to the ego from the horror that life has become because of one's own constriction of one's consciousness into a mode of aggression and avoidance rather than the fullness and openness of encountering the real with that purity and innocence of love that is our true being. And so the yogi is one who begins to journey away from the egoic hell realm and enters into a process of self-transformation to free oneself from oneself. Because one discovers very quickly that the seeker of freedom is also the obstacle to the freedom. And therefore, there must be a state in which the I thought that's always trying to get something and grasp something, whether it's physical or in the phenomenal realm, is doing the same modality of approach to God consciousness, and that doesn't work. And so there has to be ego death in order for the real essence of one's being, beginning at the soul level and then merging with that infinite consciousness, can be fully awakened, illumined, activated, and finally merged again with that level of its being that we had become cut off from. But very few are willing to go through ego death, and they'll play with that and turn it into a concept that they'll weaponize and blame the other for not going through ego death. And you go first, why should I do it? And that kind of approach that then, of course, leads to the worst consequences for everyone. And so a yogi is one who says, I'll go first. I'll go through ego death and then create a vibrational frequency of freedom that then can spread through the morphogenic field and produce blessings for all, because they will see that the quiff has been popped, the quantum qualium wave function has been decollapsed in one sector of the morphic field, and therefore the information of that achievement becomes generalized, and every consciousness then has access to instant liberation because the vibrational frequency of that has been emanated through the morphic field. And so when a significant number that has to reach a critical level of energy have popped that ego bubble and entered into the oceanic consciousness, then all the other bubbles begin to pop. And the oceanic nature then takes over, and the world dream that had become a nightmare is then easily redreamed through the liberation of consciousness itself back to its original and eternal beauty. And that becomes the world that is perceived. So this transformation that at one level looks like destruction, at another level is simply the birth pangs of the regeneration of the power of consciousness to create a realm of divine beauty, a heavenly world to replace the hellish one, and accompanied by the wisdom that is extracted from one's own suffering and turned into the power to then sustain a new age, a new dynasty, a new mandate of heaven to keep the world stable in a harmonious state of relationality among all of its inhabitants. Which is why the biblical metaphors of the lion lying down with the lamb and all of those kinds of images of peace have been perpetuated through time as an ideal that we must never give up on. And with the knowledge that as we approach the moment of the end, the urgency of that awakening and rite of passage through ego death and rebirth as spirit becomes an imperative that one feels internally, not simply because external teachings are suggesting it. And that then creates a spontaneous drive to freedom from the ego rather than freedom for the ego to continue its acting out and its projective identifications. And so this inner transfiguration of one's being, one's purpose, one's inherent growth and development and blossoming into that essential beauty that is our truth, our innermost yearning to manifest and to share and to receive brings us into a state of giving rather than taking. And it's that overflowing givingness of the soul that appreciates the divine nature in all and wants nothing from the world but to offer one's own service in the sustenance of that divine order becomes the operating principle that again awakens from within as our core blueprint of being that is originally given from the source of which we are microcosmic manifestations. And all happens in that spontaneity and oneness of the single intelligence that rules the whole and which there is no longer any sense of separation from. So that's basically the path of not just Sat Yoga, but of all of the mystical traditions. They really don't differ in that essential calling and simply have different terminology for the various phases of the journey and the ultimate reality, of course, which no name can be adequately used to describe. And so the freedom from ego requires the freedom from language, because we're addicted to the production of language in the mind. That's the soundtrack that keeps us at the vibrational frequency of the ego. And so the practice of Sat Yoga and contemplative prayer or whatever the tradition calls its mode of silencing the mind from the obscuring veil of thought brings the awareness of the intelligence that does not require language to transmit understanding, but does it through immediate intuitive transmission of the information that is present throughout the field in the purity of the qualium waves themselves, but that the mind that has been divided into subject and object and linguistic conceptualizations can no longer perceive, because it now only perceives through the filter of its representations and no longer perceives directly the real. And so the doors of perception have to be cleansed, as Aldous Huxley wrote in a famous book, which cannot be done really with LSD or other substances, although it can provide a temporary glimpse, like a windshield wiper momentarily, but the rain will come back and the windshield wiper will have no longer any value once it wears off. What needs to happen is the windshield itself must be removed. And facing the elements of our being in the glory of the nakedness of pure presence without the defense that language provides and imprisons us within. So that's basically all I was going to talk about tonight. And I want to open the floor to everyone to speak about or ask about any of the teachings of this last retreat or any other matters of spiritual interest that you would like to discuss. So please feel free to go to the mic if you have any question or anything you'd like to contribute to the conversation?
Thank you for the teachings, and thank you for your inspiration of having this space, this ashram, to be able to come to. So much has been happening. It feels like I've been here way longer than I've actually been here. There's been so much taking place. In the teaching the other day, you had said that, you know, anticipating or something along those lines, the grace that has not yet been given. And what I became aware of was it wasn't so much the grace that had not yet been given, but that I hadn't opened to receive it.
Yes.
Exactly the same thing.
Absolutely,
right?
Correct.
And then had the recognition, the awareness that being here was that grace. It was like just being filled with this, the presence and the opportunity and what's the word, the going for it, for lack of a better, to just allow, and thank goodness for Marjiva Ma, you know, to be able to just keep allowing all that to move through. And so thank you for that. I'm truly grateful. That was my sharing. My question is, if you, the other day you said something about the duality of light and awareness. And I don't know what the something was. And then there's the something of light, the duality of light and awareness. And to me, they've always been the same thing, like the two sides of the same coin. Is that
they are. They're not really separate.
Oh, okay.
However, once you enter into the field of language, you become a subject and you see a world that seems to be out there and separate from you. That world is just a world of light. It's just forms of light that have congealed into a seeming matter, but there's no such thing as matter. It's just frozen light, right? And the one perceiving it is the awareness, but you perceive it as if it's different. I and the other, right? I and the world. But no, they are actually one.
Same.
So it's the return to a oneness that never was lost, but the appearance of its being lost was caused by falling into belief that language is the way to perceive and interpret reality, but that interpretation actually alienates us.
Right. Thank you. May I ask another question? It's about a personal question.
Of course.
I got a book from the library upstairs when I came, and it was the Years of Awakening of Krishnamurti. And Krishnamurti had, in the book, he had this burning in his spine, and his was really super, super dramatic, and he suffered quite a bit from it. Since February of 2020, I've been having burning in my spine. But the only time I'm aware of it, and I can only say it started in February 2020 because I became aware of it. I don't know if it was going on before or not. But what happened is that I come to this half, in the middle of the night when I, after sleeping, I come to this half awake, half asleep state, and I can feel my spine absolutely on fire. It used to be right from the tailbone right up to the top, like just horrendous. And I couldn't, because of this half awake, half asleep state that I go into quite often actually at night, but with this burning, I can neither wake myself up fully nor go back to sleep. And so it's been going on for quite some time. And then the day after, or the morning that I get up from that, I have this axe split my head. Like I can see the axe, you know, in my mind, the axe come down and split my head, just like if you're splitting wood. Blockhead, right? Anyways. And then, but the other night, I've only had it once here, and I woke up, but instead of going through the narrative of trying to wake myself up and I've got to get out of this or whatever, I just looked up. Like I just looked up, and then the next thing I knew, I was waking up, like literally waking up hours later probably. But, and there was no axe in the head, but there was a drill. Like a boring
at the top of the head.
At the top of the head, like a boring And the only way I could deal with it was to stay busy. Because every time I went into it, I felt like I was going to be sick. Mm-hmm. And so I just, if you have, and I read that whole book, waiting for the answer at the end. And there was no answer. They never shared about why that was happening for him.
Yeah, there's actually more information in Gopi Krishna's books about his Kundalini experience. But everyone is unique. And so for some of this, I think you and I need to meet personally and privately to really have time to go into the causes of why the Kundalini got stuck, right? There must have been some trauma to the neck or the thyroid or something else. Did you have any sort of or any experience of choking or of anything? Mm-hmm. No, but there's some reason why the Kundalini can't get through the Brahmarandra and why the drilling is a kind of a counteraction of the soul that's trying to free you. From a sense of being trapped, probably produced by some trauma of fear in which you had to contract. And in a sense, not be too sensitive at the skin ego level, but to go inward. But it was a kind of inwardness that was a flight from the external rather than a blossoming and a transcendence. And so it ended up cooping your life energy into a closed segment of that Kundalini flow that should go through, according to this Shumna, right, the central pillar, mm-hmm. not the Ida and the Pingala, which have to do more with cognitive and emotional diversionary defenses, mm-hmm. but to then go through the crown of the head and into the infinite, and for you to realize that you were never even in your body, right? Mm-hmm. So that identification that is still somewhat trapped in that, in the Kundalini, let's say, stagnation, still needs to be fully released, okay? But it can be done quickly now because you're very ripe and ready for it. And so I hope that when we sit together, we can reach that liberation.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Should know better. Thank you, Shinya, for tonight. I was particularly interested in when you said you talked about rapport and having rapport, and you spoke about a divine eros. Mm. And then you mentioned sort of the shadow of that, intimidation and seduction. But I wonder if you could speak more about the divine eros and how to awaken that and how to turn the intimidation and the seduction into the how to sublimate that.
Mm. Well, the Christians tend to separate eros from philia and agape. Right. But if we're in non-duality, then those three have to be actually a single power, right? Mm. And in the ancient world, eros was a god and was actually different from Cupid or Kama, which was more the desire realm. And you remember Shiva blasting Kama with a laser beam from his forehead. But Eros is the actual upper death drive. It wants to reach and express its divine love that's overflowing and overpowering and that will not allow egoic resistance to get in the way. And it's the invincibility of that power of love, which is the divine eros, that is able to enable one to take risks and leaps and and creatively flow in spontaneity and total trust that whatever is needed in any moment, it will arise, and all will be given in accord with the infinite benevolence of the creator and pervader of the world. And so it's that love that is of the God self, but that one perceives in every moment and in every being and in every phenomenon, that just fills one with a kind of uncanny joy that has no reason whatsoever, no why. Because why do you love them? You know, there's no. It's just how incredible and astonishing and amazing every moment of consciousness is. And when we perceive it without the veils and the lenses, the distorting lenses of the ego, we see that divine beauty. Our doors of perception are cleansed by Eros. It's love that's willing to go out of itself, out of the egoic cloister, into the infinite, and express itself in that holiness of the wholeness of joy and love that perceives the not only the beauty but the essence of oneself in every manifestation, in every form, and therefore cannot project anything except the energy of love itself, which is what creates rapport, right? Because love loves love and usually doesn't get it, right? But it's that enables us to have a heart-to-heart relationship. And if it's not heart-to-heart, but head-to-head, you're going to be butting heads soon and not actually having a true encounter or meeting or a possibility of a re-merging of consciousness into a super-organismic whole, right? And that is what brings the greatest joy of all. So that divine Eros is the drive to live in that state where all is the purity of goodness and love and beauty, and to continue to uncover more of the astonishing truth of the depth of multi-layered consciousness and intelligence that every character in the play is capable of expressing if the chains of their particular karma of the past character that has caused it to contract into a defensive mode are open through the heart's realization of the immediacy of love and of freedom from the past. And it's when you are in that state of presence that you transmit that freedom that can unshackle the other's fear of meeting you in that same open ground of infinite unity. So that to me is the fulfillment of divine Eros. We could obviously talk about how is that practically manifested in every situation, but you know, then we would get into a whole seminar. But I hope that gives the essence of the feeling I meant to communicate.
Absolutely, supremely and completely. Thank you very much. Very, very helpful. Thank you, Shinya.
Thank you, Nirgun. Bruce.
Okay, a question from Ute. Thank you very much for this teaching. In which way does the qualium wave play a part in this teaching more so than the quantum wave? From what I've understood, it is that the qualium wave has more of a personal imprint than the quantum wave has.
Yeah, the quantum wave has to do with the objective world and the qualium, the subject, the subjective functioning and sensitivity and quality of interpretation of every event. So it represents, depending on how that wave function is collapsed, it will determine how open-minded you are, how open-hearted, how capable of letting go of constraints and inhibitions, and allowing your creative genius to flow. So the more that qualium wave function is in a metastable state, in which it can morph easily and it isn't fixated, like I'm this kind of person and I never do that, you know, like Scrooge or one of these, you know, literary characters that is, formed in a particular, totally predictable way of reacting, or the executive that never takes off his suit and tie, even when he's home, you know, playing with kids. It's got to be the executive or the professor or whatever. It's that freedom from a particular way of appearing to the other that enables all of the infinite creative possibilities to begin to play with one another. And eventually, when the qualium wave function is totally decollapsed, then it's a state of total freedom from any sense of an individual being. The whole sense of having been born and with inevitable death and all of those issues that tend to subtly constrict one's willingness to play because of the fears of that mortality and all of the, its sequelae and consequences in life produce. When that falls away, then the quality of perception is free of all defensiveness and all egocentricity, and is able to function as a universal mode of divine eros. And it's mind and heart, intelligence and love that unite truth and beauty, that then peer through the consciousness that had been a subject but is no longer subjected to an individual format, that also then can transmute the quantum wave functions. And changes can happen miraculously to the body, the release of symptoms that were in the body and healing effects that can happen remotely as well. So the quantum and qualium wave functions are actually dancing with each other in a kind of double helix, like a spiritual DNA molecule. And those two wave functions are in a constant state of feedback loop and of interactivity. Okay, so I hope that clarifies that for you. Okay.
Follow up. Oh, no, a separate question. I have also a lot of exhaustion or tiredness that happens that really want me to go to bed and is completely destructive for my energy levels as well as my drive for life. Mm-hmm. Could you please talk more about
that? Yeah, I would say, see, that starts at the qualium level. There's a depression that creates that tiredness and a despair that underlies it, that then affects the quantum wave function of the body becoming fatigued. When the divine eros has broken through that depressive sanskara, which is a collapsed wave function in the qualium level, and all of the suffering of the past that had turned into a world weariness and a weariness with life and a sense of disappointment and all of that, when that has fallen away and you are freed to have that creative spark of genius and joy functioning again, the tiredness will disappear, and you won't have enough time in the day to do all of the things that your heart tells you can be done to create more beauty in the world. So, any other questions?
Recently, a couple of nights ago, I was meditating, and I had an experience of fear. A lot of fear came up. It came directly after really focusing on, it was kind of like this offering to God, just kind of whatever it takes, trying to get rid of all the dispersion and just bring that feeling to a head and just confront it. And what came up was memories of a monk who had a stroke in order to be able to gain wisdom, really, let's say. Well, at least that's how he wrote about it. It wasn't something that was a negative experience for him. He kind of used that as a portal. And in the past, I've had experiences.
You're not talking about Bede Griffith, are you? Because that happened to him. He had a stroke and he went into a God realization mode, but he didn't cause it, I don't think.
Right. In a way, it's grace. I think this is the you and I may have spoken about him before, but it reminded me of some experiences that I used to have a few years ago, where going through a similar meditative process, I would start to have fear of having a heart attack. And so my father had a heart attack when he was very young. My grandmother died of a heart attack when she was in her 40s. So, you know, you could really get stuck into the narrative of it. I tend to look at it more from the level of, you know, closed-heartedness, which is the ego's kind of mode of operation, is a killer, and just kind of move past it. But the question that came up is adrenaline, like adrenaline is something that's created through that kind of encountering of perceived fear, let's say. Is that state of heightened kind of sensitivity when the adrenaline is flowing, is that something that can be used? Because it seems like the perfect moment just to recognize the absolute illusory nature of it and kind of not identify with it. But I'm curious if there's a more absolute way to take that feeling, which isn't always there. It's a kind of unique experience in a way, and use it to really make that final cut. I've been reflecting on what you said about we make little cuts, but we don't do the kosher cut. It seems like that's the moment when the fear is actually conscious. So I'm curious how to, and if you have any thoughts on adrenaline in general, because it's kind of like a fight or flight response.
Yeah, not necessarily. See, you can have adrenaline out of joy. You go, you know, go to a rave or something, maybe there'll be adrenaline flowing, or you're running a race, or you know, you're in some kind of a challenging situation. It doesn't necessarily have to be fearful, though. But it's something that causes the body to need an extra push to get past, you know, a fatigue and a second wind and all of that. But the adrenaline is not in itself either positive or negative. It's the interpretation. So it can be produced by fear and fight or flight mode, but also of joy and let's dance through the night kind of mode, right? So I wouldn't castigate adrenaline.
Would you even say that my seeing adrenaline in that way is based on on previous experiences?
So there, that's the fixed qualium wave that creates the fixed quantum wave reaction. So this is a very important point, I think, that actually relates much more generally to people. Most illnesses that are passed down through family generations the allopathic doctors assume it's genetic or something. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's the signifier that gets passed down. Mm-hmm. And then it is mimetically imitated out of the desire to be one with the ancestors, right? And so it becomes a family curse, but also the signature of the family identity. And it has both a positive and negative. It's the scapegoat and the idol, both, right, at the same time, to use that Girardian model. And I think in a certain way, as you described, you got that fear from knowing the ancestors had the heart attacks, and therefore you're next, you know. So that was, you know, put into you as you should fear this, you know. And then, of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And when the adrenaline goes and the heart starts beating, and then you say, ah, it's happening, I'm having the heart attack, right? So it's just a jouissance of entertainment that unites you with the family system at the same time that it threatens to kill you. Right? So yeah, it's just a play. And you can change the interpretation of it, and then the play will change.
So the correct response, in a way, is no response. Like, consider that kind of adrenaline and whatever is happening.
Yeah, I would witness it.
As part, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I would assume if it's happening in a meditation, adrenaline is not what you want. You want the pineal gland to produce some DMT for you, you know. So I think there'll be a different order given to the whole endocrine system to produce a different set of secretions that will bring you into a much higher state.
Okay, I'll try it out. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I'm wondering what you think of all these techniques that got really suppressed, like from Tesla and Rife and Reich and this frequency inventions that they came up with that cured supposedly cancer and shifts your frequency, and also I don't know if you keep up with Dan Winter and the techniques that he's developing to get the pineal gland to implode and create, you know.
Yeah, I tend to think that many of these things are commercializations and unnecessary intermediaries. You don't need the Rife machine. All you have to do is have the right vibrational frequency that you need to have directly. And it can't really be given by a machine or by any particular technique, because it has to do with the qualium wave function itself shifting that opens you to a frequency that will heal your body. But the only way your body gets healed is when the root of the meaning of the symptom is released. And there's no more fear of that meaning or belief in it or any sense of identification with what the symptom is producing in one's life. And then that karma dissolves and turns into both the power of life to heal itself in its vehicles, but also then into the freeing of consciousness to rise to higher levels of its own fullness. But I think to externalize it and depend on techniques or other people or even techniques that you learn, types of pranayamas and all of that, I think none of that is really necessary. And what it does is identify you with the body or the technology rather than with pure spirit. And so then it creates almost a dependency on those same machineries or techniques or people who are teaching different things. Because ultimately, you know, you have the answers, you have the wisdom, but you have to access it within, and no techniques or machines will do that. you have to overcome your defenses against knowing who you are and why you created those in the first place, and free yourself to know again your own infinite energy field, and realize that that field, once you allow it in, will dissolve your ego, and be willing to go through that dissolution that frees you from all limitation. That's the ultimate healing, and it can't be done through technology.
Do you think, though, that like what you've said previously about, you know, you can get a glimpse from, say, ayahuasca or LSD,
sure,
that maybe this machines could give you a little shake up and show, just bring the frequency in for it, but you have to do the work yourself.
Yes, it's possible that it will, but if it does, it's because of the placebo effect. Okay, so two people can have the same symptom, use the same machine, one gets helped by it and the other said it didn't work. Why? Because one subjectively was ready to go through that process, and the machine was just the excuse to make one feel like I can let it happen, but I don't have to take the blame for it, and it fits into one's a larger paradigm of reality to give the technology to the credit to the technology, and it keeps one again in a kind of a modality of consciousness that's based on a certain externalized and determined mode of belief that matter can determine mind, rather than mind being primary and determining the state of the matter of your body. And so the placebo can work, but it won't get to the root that caused the symptom in the first place. And so what often happens when there is a placebo effect or a therapeutic effect of actually people go, let's say, to hypnotherapy and the hypnotist gives certain suggestions and voila, one is free of symptoms that were psychosomatic. But other symptoms may then ensue because one didn't get to the root of it, just the current expression of a certain agony that was at a deeper level. So you need to get to the root of all the internal conflicts, and then you see that there is nothing you need from outside. It's all within.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Also, this just popped into my head. From my last session with Marjiva, I was like, I don't think I feel envy for anybody. And she said, you better look a little deeper. I just felt envy because I want that thing coming up and down, Kundalini. So I didn't have to look very far. It didn't take very long.
And if you let go of the envy, it'll happen.
Thank you.
Namaste. Okay, last one, I think.
Okay, this one's from Tatiana. I keep reading about a golden age that is coming around 2032, while you talk about the imminent end of the world. Can you please comment on this?
Well, I don't know where you read that, and you know, I don't have a timeline. The golden age is coming, but it won't come before the destruction of the Iron Age that we're now in. So you don't get a free ride into a golden age until all the traces of the Iron Age consciousness have been purified and released. And so there's a process that the world has to go through. I do think it will happen actually even before that date, but it will be a... It will be an event of such a magnitude that it will require and bring about a complete release from the current level of consciousness. That will happen either through the death of the body or the death of the ego. and everyone has the choice of which way they want to return to the light. But if it's through just the physical death that did not eliminate those qualium wave functions of the egoic mind, then they go into suspended animation, but they remain present as a latent informational pattern that will then cause the sense of being reborn again in another Iron Age. If those sanskaras or tendencies are those that are adapted to the Kali Yuga mentality. So you want to be sure to be free of all of those collapsed and fixated patterns of thinking and feeling and of attitudes and orientation to reality that lets go of all willfulness, all demand, all a sense of a sorrow and disappointment if one doesn't get one's way. And there's a humility and an openness to learning and to growth and to free the other from one's own expectations and demands, but also to be free from that from the other. And to live in a state of self-sovereignty, which you cannot have if you're in the ego, because the ego is always dependent on the desire of the other and has envy and all of those other rivalrous attitudes. So until that is freed and one is back in non-duality, a golden age cannot arise, or one cannot be born into one, because one's consciousness has to have attained non-duality, which is infinite love and a sense of unity without conflict. And so that that state has to have been attained internally before we reach the end of this age, which I do think is happening very quickly. And that's the added urgency, but an urgency that's there anyway in every lifetime, because if you don't achieve it before the death of your own body, whether there's a conflagration at a larger level, you will still have to be stuck on the wheel of birth and death, and those sanskaras tend to get more fixated in every lifetime and more degraded. So this is the moment to give oneself the gift of release from one's ego. Okay, I hope that answers it. All right, so unless there's any burning questions from anyone, burning we had solved anyway, so we could have a watery question if you made, or airy question, yeah. Pick your element. You want burning also?
Yeah.
Oh dear, okay. I hope it's a sacrificial fire.
Thank you. My question, I haven't quite formulated it, but it, in your reply about the question of divine eros, you said this very short affirmation, which I've kept just resonating, and with a question, which I'm going to try and make, and what you said was, love loves love. Mm-hmm. And so, so the question that arose is, if love loves love, what is it that needs to happen for love to expand? Is it what you were talking about, of having a certain amount of, let's say, souls resonating with that love that will create a larger energy field that then in turn will automatically change others or touch other souls, and it'll just pop like popcorn? Or there seems to be a positive feedback cycle of love loves love, and then there's more love, etc. I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit more about that.
Yes, it has to start with a small group. that creates an energy field that then attracts others who want to live in an environment of love and trust and goodness and growth and wisdom and beauty and joy, all of that that comes with love. And so it tends to emanate an ever stronger field and then emanate outward and attract those who are seeking that vibrational frequency. So then it spreads through the morphogenic field, and those who are called and ripe to let go of their fear. You see, the problem is the ego has been hurt by toxic love and false love, hate that disguised itself as love, and the desire to control and possess and dominate that called itself love, right? So all of those false forms have caused a distrust and fear of love. So the soul that has that love stays buried behind the defenses around the heart, and the heart can then not open. So one has to be in an environment where one feels, okay, it's safe here to open up, and I'll try it. Open a little crack and let the light come in, and then see if I like it, I'll let more in. But it's usually that kind of a very fearful approach, that which is why it takes time to realize you can't really be hurt. You know, you're not really vulnerable because you're an eternal being that is not the body and is not anything that could be destroyed. So as you say, it does start with a small group. This is the history. If you look into the past, when there was a renaissance, right, or a golden age in a certain area, like on the Iberian Peninsula in the 1200s and the Italian Renaissance in the 1400s, right, and then throughout Europe, different nodes and communities would have their own little renaissance, and then usually the forces of the collective ego would come down on them, burn a few of these lovers at the stake, and then end that process again. Mm-hmm. But then the fire would spark somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it could never be put out, because it would always spontaneously combust somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now it's happening here, but it may also be happening in a lot of places that will tend eventually, I think rapidly, to form a network of consciousness that can traverse the globe and the whole noosphere of the planet and create a very almost instantaneous leap into that level of the divine light that brings the grace that ends the Iron Age and produces the new world.
It just brought to my awareness the importance that we have here of cultivating and protecting that energy field of love, because if I recognize that my ego is sprouting, let's say in a situation, not only to contain it and control it, but process it and eliminate it, purify it, because in a way we're all entangled with each other as a community. I'm speaking as an ashram and as a community, mm-hmm. and whatever I am going through might create a glitch in the field. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be, realized that, wow, it's even more important to process and to cleanse, because we have a responsibility with the rest of our tribe to maintain the highest possible vibrational frequency for everyone. Mm-hmm. And for our visitors, and for those who are online, and et cetera, et cetera.
I would say for the whole world, for nature, for all, for God, right? All of it. So yeah, we do have a responsibility, and that's why there is a dharma that protects love and enables it to grow and be purified. Mm-hmm. Because what are we vowing when we take the vow? Nonviolence, non-aggression, not lying, stealing, coveting, all of those things mm-hmm. that then produce shutting down and fear and distrust. So yes, that's basically what we're committed to and have agreed to if we're part of the community. But you can vow it, but the ego may still resist fulfilling your commitment. And that's the internal battle that requires what Nisargadatta called earnestness, but really a depth of seriousness and of dignity that you will not deceive yourself or lie to yourself or delay doing what you have a responsibility to do, even though the ego says no, and you don't let that inner brat rule you, but you overcome it with the wisdom of the real adult soul that is already in harmony with the presence of God, and you become divinized, and that is simply becoming a being of light and love. So yes, that's our function and our mission and what we have to attain, but we have these demons that have to be slain that are the egos that we think we are. This is the catch-22 that we have to somehow get through.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, I hope that this has been a useful Saturday night and that you have all used it to liberate yourself from any limitations or any qualium wave functions that no longer serve you. And you recognize that you have indeed the power to refashion your way of manifesting your presence in the world into the full reflection of the inner light and love and joy and power and creative genius to flow into the world from your true essence without any veiling or obscuring of that power. So may you all use that freedom and that internal energy of our nature to bring a new world to birth and to free all from suffering. Thank you all for your contributions. Namaste.
Namaste.